This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we will visit with Michael Waldman. He is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law. His book is The Second Amendment, a biography in which Michael Waldman contends that current members of the Supreme Court may be misinterpreting the intent of the framers of the Constitution. Also, Steve Bickmore from the LSU English Department on a young adult literature conference coming this way. And we'll hear from Greg Iles, the celebrated novelist from Mississippi, who is back after a near-fatal automobile accident 3 years ago with Natchez Burning. The book is based on some cold cases involving Stanley Nelson, who's been on this program a few times, in Concordia Parish. We'll talk with Greg Iles. But now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. We're joined to start the show by the fabulous novelist Greg Iles, who's become a tour de force in the literary world, and he is back with a vengeance with Natchez Burning, already a top seller. Stephen King calls it extraordinarily entertaining and fiendishly suspenseful. I defy you to start it and find a way to put it down. The man from Mississippi who is coming this way, he'll be at Barnes & Noble at City Place this week. Greg Iles, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Jim.
Well, you're back after a hiatus that involved a near-fatal accident. I'm sure this is something that has great relevance as far as your capacity to continue what you do best.
Well, I mean, people in Louisiana are familiar certainly with Highway 61. And, you know, about 3 years ago, I was a week from finishing this book, an earlier incarnation, and I pulled out onto Highway 61 and a truck hit my driver's door going 70 miles an hour. So took off my right leg below the knee, tore my aorta, broke 20-something bones, and I was in a coma for 8 days. So you can imagine when you wake up from that, the world looks pretty different.
Well, you can write like few people can, and this is a gift that continues with Natchez Burning. And the character of Penn Cage is back, certainly in an area that you know well. You grew up in Natchez, Mississippi.
Absolutely. And, you know, equal to Penn, I would say, is his father, Tom, who has largely been based on my father, who was a doctor in Natchez. He treated probably 60% of his patients were African-American. So growing up in Natchez, I really, as people do in the South, really saw both sides of the racial equation and the relationship. And that really is what this book about is how complex the relations really are between the races. You know, I think people in the North point the finger at the South all the time as if racism only exists here. But we here know how complicated that issue really is, you know?
Well, you were born in 1960. We're of the same vintage and grew up in similar places. Natchez, Mississippi is one of the most beautiful places in the world, but as we know, and we've had Stanley Nelson on this show many times, some of the activities going on there in the 1960s, when you were alive and well and not so far away, they were not very pretty.
Well, that's true. I mean, even when I was very young, the biggest KKK meeting in the history of the United States happened only 1 mile from my house. And I remember my dad walking me down there to take pictures. And I remember the men, women, children, excuse me, and also I remember the horses wearing robes and how scary that was. And from the time I was pretty young, my dad kept me, he told me a lot of what was going on in the community when it came to the murders, and he had an inside track being a doctor. You know, that kind of thing wasn't hardly put in the newspaper, even though it was going on all around us. But you could find out, you know, if you were inside the community.
Well, Frank Morris died in 1964, killed tragically, and certainly without any provocation. He died in a place not so far from probably where you were living at the time.
Well, absolutely, and the interesting thing was, you know, I actually went quite a bit of my life without knowing about the cases Stanley worked. And even Stanley, I believe, only really started working them heavily about 2007. So it's hard to believe you can grow up in a place and be unaware that heinous murders happen so close to you. And the Frank Morris case, along with several others, actually form the backdrop for this novel. They are certainly disguised and reinterpreted as other cases. But the cases in my book are very much based on those, or at least investigative leads at the time. And even a character in the book, quite honestly, was inspired by Stanley. I feel like guys like Stanley and Jerry Mitchell have just done heroic work on those cases, and for very little reward, you know. And sort of a tribute to their work.
The book is Natchez Burning, from Greg Iles, one of the most celebrated novelists in the world, who grew up not so far, less than 100 miles from where we're perched right now in this studio in the splendor of Natchez, Mississippi. The Denver Post says Greg is one of the most original and entertaining thriller writers around, and that he is. And this book involves Penn Cage, who learned honor and duty from his father, Dr. Tom Cage, and now the family doctor and pillar of the community, is accused of murdering Viola Turner, the African-American nurse with whom he worked in the dark days of the 1960s. Dr. Tom Cage, he is a character full of intrigue, and you speak from experience, I think. This character must be based on someone you knew.
But he's very much my dad, Jim, and, you know, my dad was kind of a hero in the local community. You know, one critic said something really interesting, referring to Kill a Mockingbird in this book. She said, imagine that Jim Finch grew up to learn things about Atticus Finch that no son was ever meant to know about his father. And that's a very good description of the front story of this book. I think we all grow up worshiping our parents to a degree. And when the day comes when that image is shattered, whether we're 14 or whether we're 40, that's a very tough day for all of us. And I think that's one reason this book is resonating so much with people. You know, you remember that day when you finally figure out that adults really don't know much more than you do, and you wonder if anybody's in control of things. And this book touches on that a lot.
297-5633 is your number. Inkster Show@WRKF.org. You may call anywhere you are at 877-217-5757. We're spending a few more minutes with the fabulous writer of renown, Greg Iles. His latest book is Natchez Burning, and it is a tour de force about life in Mississippi in the 1960s. And Tom Cage is the father of Penn Cage, who is on a quest for the truth that sends him deep into his father's past. And a sexually charged secret lies waiting to tear their family apart. As we found out from Strom Thurmond, who ran for president in 1948 and carried Mississippi and Louisiana, a lot of these people who were opposed to integration publicly, privately, it was a different story.
Well, Jim, that's one of the greatest ironies of all this. When you think about theoretical white supremacists who were nominally against blending the races at any level, when you scratch the surface, you find out they were personally involved with women from the African-American race. It's really only involvement the other way that they wanted to prevent. They didn't want interaction between black men and white women. So it was a very selective sort of racism, and pretty tragic. But let me say this. It's a pretty good feeling to be on with a fellow Southerner who knows how to pronounce Natchez. Almost every interview I've done, I've heard Natchez. I've heard a thousand other pronunciations. So it's good to be on this show.
And you know how that works. We hear New Orleans quite a bit, too. But But Natchez is a beautiful place, and I'm sure you have idyllic memories of your youth, and it is hard to fathom that some of the people you probably rubbed shoulders with were involved in some of these heinous crimes.
Well, I can tell you very quickly an interesting experience I had. I played football with a guy my age who was Jewish. And one weekend, his uncle paid us to clean out the top floor of his store. And while we were doing that, we found a list of names. And that list of names, when we asked him about it, we found out was a list of people in the community who belonged to the Klan or the Citizens Council, and the Jewish community maintained that list out of self-defense, because the Klan not only hated blacks, they were also against Jews. And when we looked at that list, Jim, there were several names on it who were parents of people we went to school with. And I'm talking about at an upper-end private school. I'm not talking about the children of the factory workers and all that. So racism certainly existed at all levels of society at that point, you know?
And that brings us to a character named Double Eagles. great name and a vicious force in this book.
I think we can, I credit Stanley for that. You know, I stayed away. I'm a Southern thriller writer, and I stayed away from using the Klan as antagonists in my novels because, in all honesty, it would be untrue. You know, the Klan was largely infiltrated and neutered by the mid to late 60s by the FBI. But when I learned from Stanley about the real-life Silver Dollar Group, an offshoot that was ultra-violent, had no meetings, wore no robes, only carried silver dollars minted in the year of their birth, and basically simply just committed murder, I knew then I really had the backdrop I wanted for this thriller I wanted to tell about the character based on my father. I mean, these were guys who were highly effective at what they did, and not one went to jail until at least 40 years after the fact.
Mm-hmm. As far as your writing odyssey, you have reached the top of your game, and you did so. It was not a path without some ups and downs, right?
That's right. You know, I'm kind of, the quickest path to, if you want to be rich and famous in this game, is to find whatever book it is that sells a lot, makes a lot of money, and then publishers like you to basically rewrite that book each time out. And we see a lot of writers doing that. At first we like it, and then we kind of tend to get bored with it. But that's the traditional path. I've really written about whatever interested me at the time all the way along, mostly books set in the South, but across a lot of different genres. And now, purely out of luck and surviving so long, I think, I suddenly found myself I'm being deluged with interest from Hollywood over this book. And I think it's because finally, after my accident, I think I just took the attitude, I'm not going to worry about whether it's going to sell or not. I'm not going to worry who I make mad. I'm going to tell it the way it was and let the chips fall. And because I've done that, suddenly these actors that I can't even believe it, they want to fly out and meet me on the road and talk about playing Penn Cage. It's surreal because I'm not doing anything different. I'm pretty much doing what I always was, just sort of on steroids.
Well, how has your writing changed, if any, and your approach to life since the accident?
It sounds like a cliche, but I think what happens is you realize, we go through our lives denying mortality, denying how fragile life is, but when something like that happens, you have no choice but to face that you have a limited number of books left to write, limited number of Christmases, those kind of things, and it makes you take a much more hardcore approach to, you lose fear, I play in a band with a lot of other writers, and one is Stephen King, and I saw Stephen get run over by that van in 1999. I didn't see it, but I knew about it and saw the results of it. And I think for him, too, is a transformative experience. You can't help but be affected in every area of your life. So in a way, that's a cliche, but it is, cliches have their basis in truth.
Well, Greg Iles is back in a big way with Natchez Burning, and you say this book was nearly complete in 2011, I think March 9 of 11, when you had your accident, and you have stayed the course. It is a book that will be part of your legacy.
Thank you very much, Jim.
Greg will be coming this way, Barnes & Noble at City Place, you'll have a chance to meet this fine gentleman who writes like few other people and grew up not so far away and has experiences, I'm sure, that are similar to those of us who were young people in the 60s and 70s. Thank you, Greg.
Thanks, Jim.
Take care. We shall return with Michael Waldman. The Second Amendment, a biography, is his book, back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It's 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. We're joined by Michael Waldman. He is the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law, a nonpartisan law and policy institute that focuses on improving the systems of democracy and justice. He was also director of speech writing for President Bill Clinton from 1995 to 1999. His book is The Second Amendment, a biography. Good morning, Michael Waldman.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's good to talk with you, and this is a relevant topic, as we know. And the basic contention I come away from your book with is that the founding fathers may have had a whole different outlook on the Second Amendment than how the current Supreme Court is interpreting the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution.
I think that's right. And in fact, throughout the country's history, we have had a lot of changes in the way we've looked at the Second Amendment. It's really not been a pure and pristine understanding of what that text means, but really we've thought about it, we've argued about it, and in a sense, each generation of Americans decides what it means all over again. You know, when you do go back and look at the founding period, the amendment and the rest of the Bill of Rights, of course, came out of the fight over the Constitution and the fear that some people had of a powerful new central government. And the purpose of the Second Amendment principally was to make sure that the state militias of the 13 states would not be crushed by the federal government. And those militias were very different from what we have nowadays. It's not the same thing as the National Guard. Every man, adult man, and eventually every adult white man, was a member of the militia their entire life, and they were required to own a gun and bring it from home. So it was definitely an individual right, but it was a right to fulfill the duty to serve in the militia. So it was a very different time, and part of what's happened over the decades and centuries, we've evolved, of course, toward a more individually focused country. And the way we see this right to keep and bear arms, of course, is more individually focused as well.
Well, as you open, you say on March 1, 1792, Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson issued a terse announcement. Congress had established the post office, it had passed a new law governing fisheries, and the states had ratified the first 10 amendments of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. The Second Amendment is one sentence. It reads in its entirety, "A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." Now, some of the justices who have interpreted the Second Amendment much differently than previous Supreme Courts, they claim to be original intent kind of justices. They're trying to get into the minds of the framers. One of those is Antonin Scalia. Based on what I read in your book, Michael, if Scalia were to get in the minds of the framers, he might be voting a different way on this.
Well, I think the framers would be very putting aside the shock the framers would have to see modern Americans show up in a time machine, let alone in robes. I think the framers would be confused by our questions, just like we're confused by their answers, because they were really, in that moment, not thinking so much about the kinds of issues we debate every day on this. Can you carry a gun? Can you have a gun for self-defense? What are the limits on who can own a gun? Because they had plenty of guns, and they also had plenty of gun laws. What I really think is that the Supreme Court's new rulings, you're exactly right, that it really was a considerable change from how the court treated this important provision earlier. The Supreme Court of the United States did not say that the Second Amendment recognizes an individual right to gun ownership until 2008. It's pretty incredible. It was really quite recently. And it had said the opposite previously, many times. And, you know, you're right that Justice Antonin Scalia wrote the majority in the Heller case, which was that 2008 case, and he said that it was the high point of his philosophy of originalism, that the only legitimate way to understand any constitutional provision is to ask what it meant to the framers and its generation at the time. But I think, actually, the Heller decision can be better explained by something else, not really by originalism, but by the fact that the country has built toward this view due to a very effective long-range campaign by gun rights supporters, by the National Rifle Association and others, to change the public's mind and change the court's mind about what this meant. You know, some people would say that far from being really originalism, it's a kind of a new example of the loose constitutional change that some of the conservatives have been upset about in the past when it was done by liberals.
297-5633, if you'd like to talk to Michael Waldman. His book is The Second Amendment, a biography. And yesterday, his book was profiled in a column in the New York Times by Joe Nocera. And Joe and Michael note that in 1939, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the nation's first national gun law, the National Firearms Act, which put onerous limits on sawed-off shotguns and machine guns. Now, today, the decision might be different. Why?
Well, the case in 1939, which dealt with, you know, if you think about it, it was sort of the era of bank robbers and Bonnie and Clyde and John Dillinger and the bootleggers, and that was what people were very worried about in those days. The Supreme Court in the Miller case in 1939 upheld the new federal gun law because it said that the restrictions on those guns were not guns for militia use, and that that was the test of whether the Second Amendment applied to a federal law. So yes, that's a very different way of looking at it than what Justice Scalia and his colleagues said, which is that there's a right to protect your home and hearth with a handgun in the Heller case. And it's also different from, as you know, of course, Louisiana and other states have constitutional provisions in their constitutions that kind of mirror the Second Amendment. And of course, the voters recently strengthened that by saying that it was a fundamental right. So it's really a very different treatment than what courts in the country had done until recently. You know, it was Warren Burger was the Chief Justice of the United States, appointed by Richard Nixon, very conservative. And he said that in 1991 that he thought the idea that the Second Amendment conferred an unlimited individual right to gun ownership, he said that was a fraud on the public. So there really has been a very significant change. And I want to make it really clear. I think that the long-term constitutional drive that the NRA and other gun rights supporters mounted is not unusual at all in American history. That's actually how constitutional change happens. So it's not it isn't really anything, I think, to be embarrassed about. It's just the way we Americans always debate what our Constitution means to us.
Well, as you point out, in 1972, the Republican platform, the National Republican Party, when it nominated Richard Nixon for a second term, favored gun control. But by 1980, 8 years later, the platform opposed gun registration. And the NRA in that year gave its first ever presidential endorsement to Ronald Reagan. It seems that something happened between 72 and 80. What happened?
That's a great question. You know, we all know the 1960s were a time of great turmoil. And there was a backlash, a reaction to some of the social changes and the liberalism, perceived liberalism of the 1960s, that manifested itself in the 1970s. You saw that in a whole host of different institutions in American society, in the churches and farm groups, and then NRA was one of the institutions. Now, the NRA has been around for a long time. It was founded after the Civil War by Union officers who were worried that their troops had shown poor marksmanship, and it was designed to help train people in shooting. You know, it came really to represent the interests of sportsmen, of hunters especially. But in 1977, the NRA, which was powerful, but it was not so deeply political, it had indicated it was going to move its headquarters away from Washington, D.C. to Colorado. And at the annual meeting of the organization in Cincinnati, 1,000 activists showed up and basically pushed out the old leadership and backed new leadership, which was much more focused on turning the organization into a constitutional crusade on the Second Amendment. And in fact, if you go into the lobby of the NRA headquarters in Fairfax, Virginia today, on the wall inside the building is the text of the Second Amendment, except it's edited. The part about the well-regulated militia, which was so important to the founders, is just edited out. So it's a real example of how a change in an organization, as part of this, it was really a reaction. You know, there was a libertarian movement among conservatives and reaction to government, and think of the kind of the reaction to Washington and big government that we've seen over many decades. That's how it was felt in terms of the gun issue. I think that people's attitudes toward government ultimately have as much to do with their posture on guns as anything else.
Well, the Second Amendment, I think it's less than 30 words. And you're saying at the NRA office that some of those 30 words have been omitted because obviously the proponents of the right to bear arms, the so-called right to bear arms, they want that last clause to be the final statement. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. But there is a clause that goes before that that is significant.
It's significant, and of course, the great mystery, what we wrestle with, and there are all those commas, and the framers believed in freedom to punctuate. You know, they didn't have quite as many of the grammatical rules as we do now, which makes things only more complicated. But this is the only part of the Bill of Rights that has an explanatory clause, and so what are we supposed to make of that? And it was very interesting to go back and look at the debates in the Congress, at the debates in the Constitutional Convention, at the debates as they're recorded in the ratification conventions for the Constitution. When people talked about the Second Amendment, they really were talking about the right to bear arms for citizen soldiers. In fact, James Madison's original proposal for the Second Amendment had a conscientious objector clause, saying if you had religious scruples, you didn't have to bear arms and do, as he said, your military service in person. So that's not to say Americans didn't. First of all, as soon as the Revolution was over, as soon as the Constitution was ratified, pretty quickly that militia system began to fade away and crumble. And as you know, the country grew west. We became more individual, more individualist. There was a lot of guns, but even and a lot of gun laws, even in the Wild West. There's a wonderful photo from Dodge City, Kansas, which we think of as kind of the frontier town. You know, it looks like a movie set, a dusty main street with the saloon doors swinging and that sort of thing. And in the middle of the town is a sign that says, "Welcome to Dodge City, firearms prohibited." You had to leave your gun at the city limits. So as the country changed, our attitudes changed. And certainly that's been true lately. My only point is that that's how we make constitutional change in America, and that if we are pretending to ourselves that we can go back in a time machine and tap James Madison on the shoulder and ask him what to do, I don't think that's really the way we should or, in fact, do make these decisions.
HB in Denham Springs, you're on the air with Michael Waldman, author of The Second Amendment, a biography. HB.
Good morning, gentlemen. Sir, I'd like to ask a question pertaining to the invasion that Russia has just in the process and already has done overseas with armed forces in the invasion of these two countries. Do you think that people like Mr. Putin always knows in the back of his mind that the love affair that Americans have with weapons and their right to bear arms is also in the back of his mind should he entertain or any other country entertain the thought of same actions here?
It's a good question. The Of course, at the time of the Constitution, the militias, the fact that individuals were bearing muskets, that was our military force, and that was what we thought was going to protect us. Now, there were a lot of people who didn't think that was enough. George Washington, for example, and other people who had actually been through the fire of the American Revolution, they actually thought we needed an army. And that's, of course, what we now have. During the War of 1812, James Madison had bragged in the Federalist Papers that because of we have a militias that will be safe. Unfortunately, during the War of 1812, the British came and sort of brushed right past the Maryland militia and burned down James Madison's house, which was the White House. So this was actually what the question you're asking is something that people really thought about a lot and talked about. And over the decades and centuries, you know, the way we protect the United States is much more built up than what any group of individual Americans with weapons could do. I mean, I think that Putin is focused on the fact that the Ukraine has an army and that NATO has nuclear weapons. And those are the kinds of things, unfortunately or fortunately, that are in the minds of somebody like Putin as he looks at us. I honestly don't think that the fact that there are so many guns in the United States probably enters too much into the calculus of somebody like Putin as he thinks about his next move.
Well, the next presidential election will likely determine a few appointees to the Supreme Court, maybe more than a few. It would seem that the Supreme Court will be the place where gun laws will be debated, and there are bound to be some laws that would affect so-called gun rights. What do you think about where the court is going and where the country is going on this issue?
You're exactly right. One thing that's interesting that has happened is, so of course the Supreme Court, as I said, did rule for the first time in 2008 that the Second Amendment means an individual right. But the court, including Justice Scalia, said quite clearly that it's a right, but that there are limits on that right, just the same as there are limits on any other right. And so what is the meaning of that? What are those limits? Well, dozens of federal courts have ruled in the last few years, democratically appointed justices, Republican-appointed judges, and overwhelmingly what they have ruled is that, yes, there's an individual right, but that strong gun laws, well-crafted nonetheless, are constitutional under that Second Amendment. The big question that is facing the courts and perhaps the Supreme Court is the question of carrying weapons, whether it's concealed carry permits or open carry. And there is a case in California where a federal court has struck down that state's law, and it may well be that case goes up to the Supreme Court in the next few years. But I do think that it is unlikely that the Supreme Court, even if there are new justices, I think it's quite unlikely that it would just overturn the Heller case.
The Second Amendment, a biography, is the book from Michael Waldman. We shall return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633, your number outside our area, 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. A few more minutes with Michael Waldman. His book is The Second Amendment, a biography, from the founding of the Republic to the Newtown Massacre and beyond. Professor Waldman portrays the evolution of a nation's passionate debate over the right to keep and bear arms. And we are at a pivot point in American history, certainly a flurry of gun incidents at schools. Does this affect public opinion?
You know, we're debating these issues, these painful issues, for the first time in a number of years. And I think that we do all look at what happened in California and what happened in Newtown with real horror, at least I do. For what it means. Now, there are obviously a lot of issues at play. Some people have pointed out rightly that their mental health system needs considerable work. But I do think that finding a way to make sure that we have enough safety so that we can't have these massacres so easily carried out is something a lot of folks are going to be talking about. You know, I saw a fascinating statistic just yesterday, which is that next year there will be more people killed in the United States by guns than by cars. That's a real change. That's not just because a lot of people are killed by guns, 33,000, but because deaths by car have gone down so much. And there was a lot of things changed. Nobody had their right to drive taken away, but we had the 21-year-old drinking age. We had put airbags and seatbelts in the cars. We made cars safer. There were a whole host of things done over time, often over the objection of the auto industry, that made cars safer. I think that some people who strongly support the individual right, who support the Second Amendment, believe that the Heller case and its enshrining of that individual right has been a good thing, because it says, you know what, there's not going to be some confiscation of guns. That's not allowed. So what can we do as a society, both to protect individual freedom, but also the public's safety and freedom from fear? And I do think that's going to be a big debate over the coming years. And again, we've always been debating those issues. We're not going to get some magic answer. It's actually up to the people, just as it says in the Second Amendment. It's the right of the people.
Did want to read an email from Wade at Louis. He says, in the 1970s, the nation was polarized by the Vietnam War and civil rights and the scandals of Watergate. We were in a troubled, difficult transition. The created political vacuums that were filled by all sorts of ideologies and groups. This arose the new interpretation of the Second Amendment.
To me, it's a very wise point. I think, I'm the very last of the baby boomers in terms of when I was born. And, you watch on TV, certainly the music of the 1960s and a lot of the going on in the 60s occupy a lot of attention. But really what happened in the 1970s has had a longer impact. The kind of conservative political alignment that came to be when Ronald Reagan was elected, all of that has really dominated this country's governance since then. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was an unsettled time, and the change in a group like the NRA was probably a part of that and also a reflection of it.
Well, it's a fine book, The Second Amendment, a biography, certainly a look at the Second Amendment that is new and old at the same time. We get a glimpse at how previous Supreme Courts viewed this amendment, and they were much different than it is today. Did have a couple of listeners who heard me say at the start that you were the chief speechwriter for President Clinton for 4 years. That must have been quite an experience.
It was, as you can imagine. He was fascinating to work with, really cared about how to communicate, had a really deep knowledge of American history, and as we all know, like to write and rewrite till the last minute. So it was never a dull moment.
Was he easy to work with?
Yeah, I found it though, because he enjoyed this process of deciding what to say. He wouldn't take the speeches we wrote and get up and read them. Of course, if he were to give a 30-minute speech, what we would give him would be 15 minutes long, and he would double it. But as you and your listeners might remember, in 2012 at the Democratic Convention, when he gave this big speech nominating President Barack Obama, and he doubled it in length, that was about kind of par for the course.
Well, thank you, Michael Waldman. Appreciate your time, and hope we talk again soon.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Take care. Bye-bye. We're joined now by Professor Steve Bickmore. He's an assistant professor of English education with a joint appointment in the School of Education and the English Department at LSU. And he is involved intricately in a young adult literature conference coming this way. Good morning, Dr. Bickmore.
Good morning, Jim. It's great to be here.
Well, tell us about the conference.
Well, the conference is an opportunity for academics that are interested in young adult literature to get together and work on their scholarship. As some people may know, an English department may have any number of professors that focus on Renaissance or modern American or modern British, but often around the country, the young adult scholar sits in isolation. So this is a time to bring them together, and we have representatives from 13 states and about 20 universities in Canada, and even a teacher from Columbia visiting our campus next week.
When do you get going?
We start, check-in will be Sunday night, and the conference starts first thing in the morning at 9 o'clock and runs till June 6th.
June 6th, so you've got people from, as you say, all over the country, including some from outside the country who'll be here. Maybe some folks don't appreciate that it takes a special talent to write for this audience.
Oh, it's kind of a gift. We find people that can do it, and once they catch on, as you had a guest on a few weeks ago who's going to be one of our visitors, Kimberly Willis Holt, writes tremendous books for both adolescents and children. And she's somebody who's been at LSU's campus, attended school there, and has written a book that won the National Book Award mm-hmm. some years ago when Zachary Beaver came to town. And reading that book would engage students in a quest to understand themselves and others in ways that really kind of give a legitimate air to books that should be in the classrooms.
Well, Kimberly Willis Holt will be there at what time?
She's going to be visiting on Tuesday. She'll also be presenting a keynote on Wednesday, and she'll be speaking and reading at the Baton Rouge Library Wednesday night.
Okay. So we'll have many opportunities to see and hear Kimberly Willis Holt, who went to LSU in the early 1980s and was a journalism student and has done very well for herself.
Extremely well.
Many others, including Kimberly, some of the other major lights, literary lights you'll have include?
The real bright star for us that's coming is an up-and-coming writer named Matt De La Pena. He's a Hispanic writer who admits that he was not quite a reader in high school and talks in great measure about how reading The Color Purple, for example, changed his life, and where he saw the other in fiction, he realized that maybe perhaps he should spend a little bit more time investigating what was in books. And as a result, he's turned out to be a great gift to the literary world. And many, many people think that his books are going to be some of the books we look back on in 20 or 30 years as books that make a difference in the lives of kids. Another one is Chris Crutcher, who writes about the trauma that kids experience. He spent 30 years or more working as a child psychologist, counseling children, and he writes what he likes to call real life into fiction. And his books are really mm-hmm. interesting tour de force on the struggles that kids undergo to live individual lives.
All right. Teresa asked the physical location. Where will the...
It'll be at LSU's campus. We're going to have classrooms. It's a conference seminar where teachers and academics will come to listen to these scholars and these writers. And we'll be primarily in Peabody Hall and in Allen Hall.
Peabody and Allen Hall, right in the quadrangle.
Yep.
So Dr. Bickmore will be there with some great writers who specialize in young people's literature. What qualifies as a young adult?
Boy, you've opened a can of worms there. I guess it depends on who you ask. One of the earliest definitions was anything that young adults choose to read is young adult literature. Most of us probably define it a little bit tighter in its books written for and about adolescence. So that might range from books that reach down to kids that are 11 and 12, all the way up to kids that are now considered maybe young adults into their 20s. So primarily books that are focused on that large group of kids that sit in the middle, that liminal space between childhood and adulthood.
When I was taking English classes at LSU, I never had any young adult books that were assigned by professors. Has that changed?
I think there's currently at almost every university a young adult literature class. If you're going to major in secondary education, most universities require that you take a young adult literature class. We teach it at LSU with great success. Kids love it. also you would find that maybe The Catcher in the Rye is maybe the book that's the grandfather of that. Most people know The Outsiders or The Contender. And those books that arose in the 60s kind of changed young adult literature. And most people point to that as the birth date of young adult literature as opposed to juvenile fiction that was maybe written in earlier generations.
Well, Steve, for those who'd like more information, how do they find out more about the conference?
Well, the biggest way is to go to the School of Education's website, and there's a link on there to the conference. I've found now that it's been referenced so many times that if you just go LSU Young Adult Lit Conference, it pops right up on Google.
And this is a week-long thing. So.
It's a week-long thing where teachers can come and earn continuing education credit. They'll work with a scholar from perhaps, say, Alan Brown from Wake Forest will be here, Judith Hain from Arkansas. There'll be people from all over the country. It's kind of hard to pin them down. Mark Lewis is coming from Loyola in Maryland, and they would work with this professor during the week and prepare a unit or lesson plans or resource materials so that they can take these materials back into the classroom and provide students with really more dynamic text that talk to their lives and still are quality literature that would allow them to meet the demands of any standard that's laid upon them by a state or a nation.
Well, we thank you for joining us. Good luck with the conference. And once again, for those who want more information, do you have a phone number that might be helpful?
The biggest phone number is just to call me at 578-2260 and leave me a message in my office phone number, and we'd be happy to respond and get in touch with you again.
All right. That's Steve Bickmore, assistant professor, who's the man in charge, person in charge of the Young Adult Literature Conference. You got a lot of help, though.
Lots of help.
And you can find him 578-2260. Is that right?
2260. Yeah.
Okay. It's 225-578-2260. Thank you, Steve Bickmore. And good luck.
Thank you.
Did want to follow up on yesterday's discussion with Melissa Flournoy and Scott Wilfong. Yesterday, the Louisiana Senate approved two anti-abortion bills. Marcia Shuler writes about it in today's Advocate, but the Senate did stop short of passing another measure aimed at protecting the life of an unborn child. One measure passed by the Senate requires women seeking abortions to have information about potential psychological and emotion impacts, and another, the one that Melissa Flournoy and Scott Wilfong discussed, bans abortion providers like Planned Parenthood from providing health education in public and charter schools. So the abortion issue continues to permeate the Capitol 24 years after Buddy Romer, then governor, vetoed two bills and probably cost Romer his political career. There were many responses yesterday from the show with Scott Wilfong and Melissa Flournoy, and most of them were not favorable to Mr. Wilfong, who, as we know, is one who speaks his mind. Here's one from Michael Hale saying, Melissa Flournoy and Scott Wilfong went at it like two old married people who should have been divorced years ago. It was all very entertaining, but what really caught my attention was the call from Denham Springs, in which a listener said he thought he was in the Twilight Zone because his tax money was paying for abortions and air conditioning for death row inmates. The reason I'm fascinated by calls like this is that they give a great insight into the conservative mentality. As Ms. Flournoy pointed out, no tax dollars go for abortions, period. I would also note that the caller probably pays a fraction of a cent per year in taxes toward air conditioning at the prison. All of that as it may, I'm quite certain that no amount of explanation or proof changes the minds of folks who think like this. And that is from Michael Hale. And another one from Ronna Gray, who, as we know, is a political operative. She says, for the third time recently, I've been tempted to turn off your radio show when your guest Scott Wilfong comes on, and you know I'm a loyal listener. I couldn't imagine him being on a respectful radio program, but today I decided my perspective would be better informed if I was open to hearing all sides of an issue, even those I consider to be lacking in intellectual value, so I remain tuned in. Of course, Scott is the architect of the infamous Kip Holden smear flyers, so it pains me to give him any time or consideration, but after listening to him espouse his views and your caller's response to him, I now believe the best way to deal with misguided people like Scott is to expose them to an educated and informed public. Lesson learned, Rana Gray. Thank you, Rana. Also at the legislature yesterday, a bill that pitted the Saints owner, Tom Benson, against his own players died. State Representative Chris Broadwater said he decided to pull House Bill 1069 because there wasn't enough time in the session for the Saints and the players to reach an agreement on a professional athlete's injury pay. Drew Brees was at the Capitol yesterday, took photos with Bobby Jindal, and Tom Benson wins again at the Louisiana Capitol. We shall return tomorrow. For Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.